When a museum or gallery displays ancient sacred art, viewers can be deeply moved by their beauty while learning about different cultures and belief systems. These holy objects are taken care of when they're added to collections, in some cases because the temples or shrines where they once stood no longer exist. But in situations where they've simply been stolen from the places where they rightfully belong, sold by thieves to unscrupulous art dealers with clients willing to avoid asking too many questions, these works may be physically protected but stripped of their context and used for profit rather than prayer. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Elizabeth Kadetsky is a 3-time Fulbright scholar in India and an editor at New England Review. Her article, The Goddess Complex, published in The American Scholar, explores the long, strange story of a group of stone deity sculptures taken out of a temple in northwest India that exists to this day. But getting the works back to their rightful location has proven a major challenge, not least because there are powerful people and institutions who simply want to possess them. Elizabeth, welcome to Think.
Hi, Chris. Thanks so much for having me.
Before anything disappeared from its original location, how did these stone figures play into worship practices in this temple complex where they'd been, since the 6th century?
Yes. So the sculptures were created in the 6th century. They were tantric gods and goddesses, mostly mother goddesses. And they sprang from a long history of tantric mother goddess worship. We don't know the exact story of how they got to this temple, because in the Middle Ages in India, there were several invasions and temples were destroyed. So these predate that period. But what we do know is that as early as the beginning of the 20th century, they were in a shrine in a remote area in Rajasthan being worshipped by the community. And over the years, that shrine has become a larger temple, so it still exists. And in fact, it's quite an active temple today. And the people who worship at the temple remember the stories of their parents and grandparents describing these specific statues. So there's a continuity at least 100 years old and probably much longer showing that this is where they came from.
Are these works considered sacred as physical objects as opposed to just maybe representing particular deities in a symbolic way?
Absolutely. In Indian spirituality, statues of deities are considered the gods themselves. So there's a really interesting history, even a legal history, where there was one case where an Indian Vishnu sculpture was stolen and the legal team decided to sue to get it back under the auspices of Vishnu. So the idea was that Vishnu himself had been violated by the theft. So yes, when you, in an Indian context, when you worship a deity, it's as if you are worshiping the actual deity when there is this physical representation of it.
How did these particular sculptures end up buried underground for, I guess, a period of years?
So there are a couple of different theories. One of them is that these were sculptures that connected to the Hindu mythology of the goddess Durga, who is also sometimes Kali. And at different times in this over 1,000-year-old history, sometimes the goddesses were seen as scary or demonic or fearful. It was a powerful feminine energy, sometimes nurturing, sometimes fearful. So at one point in the history, this is one of the theories, the worshippers decided that they were scary and that they should be buried in the ground. And there they remained for many centuries, probably, until they were dug up and brought over to this temple complex. Now, another theory is that it could have been drought and weather, and there could have been a pre-existing temple complex that was built on top of by the current temple community, and that they might have arisen from the ground, for instance, during drought. This often happens. So we don't know the exact history. Unlike some other sculptures that you see in museums, these are freestanding sculptures, so there aren't break marks, which you can sometimes see in other sculptures. So that means that They might have come from someplace else, but not someplace very far away. And another interesting piece of the history is that there is a warm spring that goes through the temple that's there right now. And a lot of historic temple complexes would be built around the rivers. And some of these rivers, according to theories by archaeologists, go all the way back, all these riverbeds go all the way back to the Indus Valley civilizations.
Wow.
So over the centuries, over the millennia, communities would build new sites over old, excuse me, over old sites. So in the area where these particular goddesses were found, just nearby, there was a second century Buddhist site that was discovered in the 1960s, around the same time actually that these sculptures were discovered. So it was a time that a lot of new discoveries were being made. So the idea is, we don't know exactly how they came out of the ground, and we don't even know exactly where they belonged at the very beginning of their lifespans. But we know it was someplace very close to that area. And this all, of course, plays into the idea of who is the rightful owners of these sculptures. And one of the defenses that some of the museums that are holding these sculptures have offered is that, well, we don't really know that they came from this particular temple. And this temple community is making a claim for the sculptures. And the counter argument is, well, they might have come from a different temple 100 meters away. To me, that's all very cynical. Obviously, they come from this particular area, and obviously, they have meaning to that community, and obviously, they were stolen from that place in the early 1960s.
So there are sculptures of this nature in many parts of India and in fact in many parts of the world. What made these particular figures we're talking about today so extraordinary and so desirable, divorced from that, just as works of art?
Well, they happen to be extremely beautiful. Of course, it's hard to be objective, but they're unusual for Indian sculptures. They're quite naturalistic. They definitely represent gods and goddesses, which you can tell because each one has a plate behind its head. So that is a symbol of, it's a nimbus, it's called. It's a symbol of divinity. But aside from that, they really do look like people. And they also look like people from the region, which is quite different from Indian artworks from North India that have a Roman influence. In the north, a lot of the sculptures have a very Western feel to them. They almost look like Greek or Roman statues with Indian dress or Indian symbolism. These ones have a much more indigenous look to them. But they're not really comparable to some of the later Indian works that are more iconic with extreme angles, a kind of very dramatic, decorated look to them. These are very, very simplistic, and the faces are very human-like and very nurturing, very sweet. And it's also the stone. It's a stone that in the region is called Pareva, which is blue-green, and it's a kind of schist. It's very shiny and almost iridescent, and quite beautiful and quite unusual. So if you were to walk into, say, the Cleveland Museum of Art, where one of these is still on view, in fact, I think it's probably the only one that you can see on view in the West right now. It really stands out in that gallery. It's a little bit smaller than the other Indian and South Asian sculptures nearby, and it's this deep blue-green that kind of shines, and it just looks very naturalistic, and you almost have trouble placing it. So, interestingly, when the figures were discovered by an Indian archaeologist in the late 1950s, he was very drawn to them, partly because there was a Western sensibility that would be pleased by these sculptures. And this was somebody who had been trained in Western archaeology in pre-independence India. So he was Indian, but really looking at them from a somewhat Western point of view. So he is the person who we could say brought them to light for Western audiences. And then it was shortly after that, probably because of their publication in a journal in India in 1959, and then again in 1961, that they were stolen. And the people who stole them obviously knew that they would capture the hearts of American and Western audiences.
Yeah, this is so interesting. There's this article about the sculptures published in 1957, and then it's just 4 years later that most of them were stolen. What do we know about where they ended up?
So the first one that left the country wound up at the British Museum. It was entered into the British Museum collection in 1963. We don't know exactly when it arrived. It can take a year or more for a sculpture to actually become part of the collection. And that was sold by an interesting figure who does not appear in the public record very much. He was a race car aficionado who hung out in art circles, but was not a well-known art dealer and had been spending time with his wife in India. Around the same time as that, an American woman named Doris Wiener, who was then around 40 years old. And she's a very fascinating figure, an immigrant from Russia and a New Yorker. And she also was traveling around India and just getting started as an art and sculpture buyer. And the story that I've been able to piece together so far is that she possibly actually went to this temple, which at the time was quite remote. There were panthers, there were thieves prowling on the paths. The worshippers at the time wouldn't even go to the temple by themselves. You always had to go with somebody else because of the dangers. So somehow we think that Doris Wiener got herself to the temple and saw the sculptures and communicated with a middleman arranging for their theft. Now, we don't know this for sure, but that is a theory that's out there with law enforcement. And it is known that Doris Wiener, who later became one of the top dealers to the New York museum world and museums all over America, that she never went to auctions. She didn't shop at Christie's or Sotheby's. She found her art herself. And that's partly how she became so successful. She had a fantastic eye and she knew what museum curators and collectors would want. And so she fell into the circles of the most eminent art world in New York and elsewhere. And she was selling to the Rockefellers and to the Cleveland Museum of Art and some of the top collectors of the time.
What story did Doris Wiener tell about how she acquired these things? Clearly, she didn't walk around saying, I contracted with a thief, and 2 years later, they showed up.
She was quite circumspect about what she did. So she never revealed her secrets. She passed away in 2011. And in 2016, the Manhattan District Attorney's Office filed a huge lawsuit against her daughter, Nancy, who is still alive. And Nancy was indicted for conspiracy, and her mother, who had already passed away, was named, you know, or you can't indict somebody who's already passed away. But Nancy had inherited Doris's business. So finally, Doris took a plea bargain when the case was resolved just a few years ago, and Doris cooperated with the authorities. So none of those files are available for the public. So it's really, you know, what I've been able to get from law enforcement. But what I find really interesting about this story is that it really took place at the beginning of the trade. So how these networks were put in place, that today we see there were maybe 20 big dealers who were responsible for getting artworks into LACMA. Dallas Museum of Art, you know, at one time had quite an Indian collection. And Doris was there at the beginning.
Elizabeth, before we go too much further with this, I think you and I both agree that these objects belong to their rightful owners. They belong to the communities from which they were stolen. Beyond simply the morality of that, what is lost when objects like these Tandisar sculptures are taken out of the places where they have been for such a long time and then placed in a private collection, whether that's with a collector or in a gallery or with a museum?
Right. Well, three things really. The first you already mentioned is just the ethics of what happened and stealing patrimony from people. Like if you were to come into my house and steal my grandmother's pearls, I would be quite upset. But number two, there's the archaeological record. So when you take something out of its context, you can't get back all of the information that was there at the time. So even if these sculptures were returned to that temple right now, you've lost a huge amount of context from just what archaeologists would be able to dig up and find in the environment at that time. And then a third thing is that this is a collection of sculptures. So there were probably 12, as many as 14 at the temple or the shrine at the time, and they go together. And for me, I have a bulletin board above my desk. I'm looking at it right now, and I have photographs of all of the sculptures in all of these different contexts over time. And it's wonderful for me to just look at these Xeroxes and see how they interact with each other. But of course, that's nothing like seeing the sculptures together. So these sculptures, not even two of them have been in the same place since probably 1979, when two of them were together in a museum in India for several years. One of them was then moved to a different museum in India, in Delhi. But aside from that, these sculptures have been separated from each other. And just from the point of view of art, to see how they complement each other and what references they make to each other and how the stone itself, I mean, these were carved from the same stone. So to see objects next to each other that might have the same striations would just be so incredible. And then, of course, if you want to think of it from a spiritual point of view, what would be the incredible power of seeing these goddesses and their attendant gods arranged the way that they were created, in a certain order with certain stories that are implicit in how, say, there's a Ganesh that's part of it, how the Ganesh would be arranged on a certain side of the group of goddesses. So all of that is lost when here they are in different museums all over the world.
I want to be really careful not to sort of exoticize these works. They were familiar and much beloved by the community that surrounded this temple complex. They weren't lost or missing for this community, but they were in a place that many people, especially in the West, would have considered remote. This Indian archaeologist who published the first piece about them, sort of alerting the world to their magnificence and their very existence, surely would have known, right, that this might have caused them to be objects that collectors coveted. What was his motivation in writing about these things?
You have to walk back about 60 years and imagine the time and place. So, when he discovered them, it was 1957. That's 10 years after the independence of India. And it was an exciting time, obviously. And the art world, especially, was reinventing itself, and archaeology specifically. So, archaeology in India had been invented by the British, and the British Indian Archaeological Survey was, by definition, a racist white supremacist institution that was trying to prove that the treasures from the ground and even the Indus Valley civilization had been a foreign, wonderful civilization that had nothing to do with the Indian people who lived there in the present day. Present being 19, say 1946. So this man, his name is Ratna Chandra Agarwala. He had actually trained in the British Archaeological Survey in India, and in 1946, he was working under the last British head of the survey, who was a famous racist and who beat people who were working on the site. And it must have been tremendously exciting for the British to leave and for the Archaeological Survey to suddenly become an Indian-run institution. And the people who took over the Archaeological Survey had to reinvent archaeology. And one of the things that they began to do was to try to teach Indian people about their own history and the importance of recognizing Indian art as something that came from India that people who lived there could, that ha they had a claim to. But secondarily, there was also a history of Indian art as having been seen as anthropology and not art. So these nationalists in the new archaeological survey wanted to prove to the rest of the world that Indian art received deserved recognition along the lines of what Greek or Roman art received in the world. So there was a view outward to the West. These were all people who had trained in a Western style, and many had even lived in the West. And they wanted recognition from the West.
So I'm really interested to know about the people who bought from dealers. I mean, you can it's easy and understandable that Doris Wiener is posthumously being prosecuted for these potential crimes as a dealer. But she had clients who clearly were willing to either accept her version of events or not ask any questions at all about the provenance of these objects. What do we know about the people and institutions who bought these things?
It's so complicated. One of my goals in writing this story was to try to understand the human side for everybody involved, even Doris Wiener, who is considered a villain at this point in the repatriation conversation. But certainly the people who were buying from her were complicated figures. And one of the most well-known of them was Sherman E. Lee, who was the curator, top head curator, and director of the Cleveland Museum of Art at the time. And he made one of the first big purchases of one of the sculptures from the set from Wiener. And in some ways, his purchase legitimized the purchase of the sculptures for others who went and followed suit. Sherman E. Lee had a deep history in Asia, and he had even met Agrawala in 1946 in India. So he knew what was going on in India. He also, in the early 1960s, he had curated a show at Cleveland that was based on loan. It was a show of Indian artworks, and all of the artworks were loaned from Indian museums, which is something that's unheard of today because now we have shows that are all looted artworks that are owned in the United States. So Sherman E. Lee contacted museum curators all over India, and he developed relationships with them. And these sculptures were shipped to Cleveland, and this wonderful show took place that was an example of what it's like to have transnational cooperation and communication and respect. And somehow, within the next decade, everything went south. And so Sherman was also somebody who was out there making proclamations about looting, which was well known. It was well known by the mid-60s that there was a big looting problem in India. And he, Sherman, was even receiving letters from these people who he had gotten to know in Indian museums, telling him about the looting or telling him about particular objects that had been looted. And he would write back to them and he would say, "This looting is so terrible, and we good-hearted art lovers in America want to do everything we can to stop the looting." And also at the same time, UNESCO was beginning hearings and discussions to create what later became its guidelines on trafficking that went into effect in 1972. So this was part of the conversation. Everybody knew that looting was a problem and that it was bad. And Sherman somehow decided to go ahead and make this sale anyway. And I found correspondence between him and Doris Wiener and between him and other people that really confirmed this, that he confronted her about it. And he said, "You know, I saw this article from 1961 by R.C. Agrawala saying that these sculptures are under worship. So how did they get to you? How did you get them? And can you provide a title for them?" And I didn't find a response to that in the file, but somehow he decided to go ahead with the sale anyway. So what was going on in his mind? I'm sure there was a lot of rationalization. I'm sure he didn't want to say it, but he probably thought, well, We are going to take care of these sculptures, and all of those condescending narratives about why these sculptures might belong in Western museums.
I mean, it's sort of painful when institutions, will talk about preserving these things. It sounds very colonialist. There have been concerns, though, over time, right, that the works like this might degrade if left in situ. Is that a reasonable argument?
It's mixed. I think that in this particular case, there's an element of the story of repatriation fever right now in regards to India that hasn't been talked about that much, which is what happens when the sculptures go back to India. This particular set of sculptures, I think it's unlikely that the Indian government would send them back to the temple. So if you look at it from that point of view, it makes it a lot more complicated because then the question is, should they go back to the country as opposed to should they go back to the temple? So even putting that aside, if they do go back to the Indian government would likely put them someplace where they would be protected, in a museum that has the proper conditions for it. So in some ways, it's a hard conversation to have about Indian sculpture right now because I don't think the Indian government is that likely to return sculptures like this to temples that wouldn't be patrolled by security and where they might be exposed to the elements. So in a more objective situation where we could say, oh, well, they will go back to the temple. There's a lot of Indian artwork out there. There are a lot of examples of beautiful South Asian art in American museums that arrived much earlier, that arrived before this rapacious looting traffic of the 1950s, 60s, and 70s. And I think some of those are really beyond reach of repatriation right now. I think that's a different conversation. But for instance, the Boston Museum of Fine Arts has a collection that was put together by Ananda Kumaraswamy in the 1920s. It's a beautiful collection. And Kumaraswamy had a lot of very deliberate ideas about bringing Eastern Indian art to the West to be appreciated. And I don't think that that collection is going to go back anytime soon. And if it were to, it would be a really complicated conversation because of Kumaraswamy's role in it. So I think an argument can be made that there is enough beautiful South Asian art in galleries in the West that we don't need these hundreds, thousands of objects that were looted in the most base way at this particular time, that people should worship them if that's what they want. And yes, these sculptures would be degraded in some ways, but that's what they were made for.
Elizabeth, you mentioned in the piece there are now institutions that what are hesitant to display certain works because of controversies over them. Like, are ironically, have pieces been looted, taken into museum collections, and now are not even able to be displayed because of this bad behavior?
Well, it's even worse than that. Some of them are just not displayed because they don't have room. So when I started working on this piece, it was actually before law enforcement had gone public about the fact that they were investigating these sculptures. So I didn't actually know that law enforcement was looking into them. And so at the time, I started traveling around going to visit the sculptures, and I was able to visit the one at the British Museum, which was off view because they didn't have room. Only 1% of the British Museum's collection is actually on view, and this is a largely colonially collected collection of objects that are in storage. I was actually able to get into the storage area and see these thousands and thousands of objects that are not on view because there's not room for them. The one in Cleveland, as I said, was on view. The one at the Met, which is no longer there because it was confiscated, was on view, so I was able to see it. But the one in Los Angeles was not on view because of space issues. And the one at Oberlin College was also not on view, but because that's a college, The objects in its collection are considered educational or research material, and so the idea is that they come out of storage when somebody makes a request to see them. So it's only now, since the lawsuit was filed or the criminal case was filed in August of 2022, that the museums are not cooperating with researchers. So if somebody were to start doing this research right now and go to LACMA, for instance, they wouldn't be able to see the sculpture, and I'm pretty sure Oberlin wouldn't show it to them either. The one at the Met is the one that has the most interesting story, because the Met was served papers at the very end of August 2022, and they communicated with the DA's office and immediately took the sculpture down. And the DA's office said, well, we don't actually have room in our facility because we have so many sculptures that we have seized for repatriation. So you can hang on to it for now, but take it off display. And if you want, you can build the box, build the crate for it to be shipped in. So the Met built the box and put it in the box, and it sat there for quite a while before the DA's office had room. And then the DA's office took the crate, and the last I spoke to them, the crate was still there waiting for the judge to finally proclaim on that particular case. So, yeah, so you can't see that sculpture, and neither can anyone else.
Elizabeth, what did local residents know at the time when the people were stole when the pieces were stolen about who had taken them? Did they report these thefts to police?
So I was able to visit the temple a couple of times. The first time I visited in 2020, it was before the sculptures had received any attention really by, let's say, law enforcement. The people at the temple didn't know that there was a legal case in the United States. And nobody who was an outsider had visited the temple for several years. So when I showed up, people were like, yeah, it's this old story. These sculptures were stolen and we want them back. But there wasn't a sense of urgency about it. The interesting history was that in 2003, the community had started to receive visits from Indian law enforcement because there was a major Indian case of a smuggler who was arrested in 2003. And there was some belief that he might have been connected to the theft of these sculptures back in the early 1960s. Or perhaps another one of the sculptures had appeared in this smuggler's collection later. In fact, he would have been only about, I think, 5, 6, 7 years old when the original theft occurred. So it's unclear how or why Indian authorities connected the temple to his case, but it did result in an Indian policeman going to the temple and interviewing people. So that was the first time that people in the temple community started to believe that that the sculptures might come back to them. Now, in some ways, they were misled by the police, because after that, the Indian police dropped the case. So when I showed up, this was now 17 years later, there had been an old man who was interviewed by the Indian policeman, and at the policeman's urging, likely, he wrote up a complaint, which nothing happened with, and it was directed to the local police station. So this complaint was written in 2003. The theft was probably in 1961, 62, 19, around there. So this is more than 40 years after the theft. But the man who was in his 80s at the time in 2003, he had specific memories. Some of the memories were somewhat verbatim from the article from 1961. Sorry, this is a lot of dates to keep straight. But clearly, the police officer had shown him the article from 1961. But he also had very clearly from the text of this transcript, legitimate, real memories of the sculptures from the time. So when I showed up, In 2020, 17 years later, this gentleman had passed away, and his son was part of the temple community, and his son pulled the complaint out of his pocket. It was a Xerox. It was written in Hindi, and showed it to me. And I could pick up pieces of it, but I had a friend translate it for me. And it said, we want the sculptures back. And at that point, I think that people didn't really expect that they would ever get them back because it had been, 17 years since the last police officer had arrived. Then it turned out that the Manhattan DA was looking into it. And over the years, the Manhattan DA had also sent somebody to go interview people at the temple. So they had also received that inkling that they might get it back. But what happened between 1961 and 2003 is that there was so much looting going on that I think at the time of the theft, it was upsetting, tragic, terrible, and also a completely normal thing to happen. So the temple community, according to the people I spoke to many years after the fact, reported the theft to the police. There's no record of that anymore. And what I was able to pick up from members of the temple community was all hearsay and oral history. And there were several different versions of it. So one of them was that people came to the temple in the morning and the sculptures were gone. Another version was that a man came in a car and took them away in the middle of the night. Another version was that somebody who was known to the community and had a name or went by a nickname, Kadva Baba, that he came and spoke to the priest and gave him money and left. And then the sculptures disappeared shortly after that. So none of that is provable. It's all hearsay. We don't really know exactly what happened. And we also don't really know what the life of these sculptures was in the imagination of the community in the years after that. Because there really is a gap between 1961, 62, and 2003 when they started to appear on law enforcement radar.
It is pretty extraordinary that people in that community didn't forget about these things, though, right? I mean, that 60 years is a long time, 40 years is a long time. One would think that as the generations moved on, nobody would talk about these things anymore. That is very much not the case with these.
Well, oral history is just so fascinating. I definitely felt that when I made my first visit there in 2020, that I was getting so many layers of the story. There was the story of 2003 when the policeman came. And even that story was an old history, so I was getting second, third-hand story versions of that story. And then, of course, the story in 2003 was a story that was also passed down. It's so hard to get at the truth, but in some ways, the community testimony is significant. I think, just as you say, that it shows that these sculptures existed in the life and imagination of the community, and we'll never know what the exact facts were because that's not really how oral history gets passed down. But we do know that it had meaning. And then there was this great anecdote that one of the times when I was at the temple, there was a priest there. It was a priest who was from out of town. So the way the temples work is that any priest can come and do a ceremony at a temple. So they don't have to be a member of the temple. And so this priest was from out of town, and he was leading some people in a ceremony. And he and I started chatting. He was very kind and wanted to tell stories. He was a good storyteller. And he told me one of the legends of this particular temple, which has this hot spring going through it. And he told me the story of the cow. It turns out it's a famous Hindu myth of the cow Surabhi. But the way he told it, it was just a cow from the area, and that there was a farmer whose cow kept disappearing, and the cow would come back dry of milk. So the farmer decided to follow the cow one day, and the cow came to the shrine, and just released its milk into the ground. So the farmer had thought that someone was stealing the milk, but no, the cow was just giving it to the ground, and then a Shiva Linga appeared on the very spot. So everybody knew that this was a sacred spot. And then this priest, after telling me the story, he said, and another legend of this temple is that a goddess was stolen from this temple many years ago, and that now the government is going to send her back. So there's this way that storytelling, I think, is somewhat unliteral, but then it tells us an emotional truth. And I think that that's a good way to read the oral history of the theft of the sculptures. And then, of course, we have a record that backs up that history, which is the article that was published, the two articles, the first and then the second one in 1961 that had the photographs. And then there's a paper trail from that point showing how these sculptures got to the museums in the West. And that's quite unusual for a lot of looted artworks. So that's one reason that this particular case is very exciting, because it's so clear where they came from.
Elizabeth, what are the lessons from this story about how we prevent these kinds of thefts, how we keep people from profiting from the sale of stolen art and antiquities, and how we hold people accountable for things they possess that they shouldn't legally and ethically have?
If you go back and research what was happening in the 1960s, when this looting complex really got off the ground in India, what you see is that it was at a small enough scale at the very beginning that you could really point your finger to a handful of players. And a lot of those are the players who show up in this particular story. So it's Doris Wiener. There were a couple of other dealers who were operating in the same space who are also well known. And then the people who were buying from them, the Rockefeller, John D. Rockefeller III, and his wife, Blanchette, who were the founders of the Asia Society, Sherman E. Lee from Cleveland Museum of Art, and Nasli Hermannic, who was a very respected dealer at the time, and who donated two of the or who loaned two of the sculptures to LACMA in Los Angeles, and Paul Walter, who was a very respected dealer who had gone to Oberlin College and donated that sculpture to Oberlin. At that time, it would have been easy, I think, for law enforcement to do a sting and find these 10 people and make them stop. Of course, 20 years later, the racket was so huge, and every museum in America had already purchased items from the looting network, that suddenly it was a morass, and it was maybe really difficult at that time to start teasing it apart. So what the Manhattan DA's office is doing right now is quite heroic, really. I mean, they are doing a huge amount of research to start untangling these stories, and so many people were involved by the time you look at some of the cases that they're looking at. They're looking at thefts that were taking place in the early 2000s. So at that time it was entrenched. But if you go back and you say, well, why did people allow this to happen? And I think that racism is a big part of it. And I think that unstated idea that at the end of the day, Western museums were the safest and best places for these objects, and that people in South Asia didn't deserve to have their own patrimony, or it didn't matter if you stole it from them. So that's a powerful lesson too, that this level, at so many levels right now, we're examining institutional racism. And we have really, I mean, we as a society have been focusing on the more nefarious institutions, looking at police, schools, healthcare, places where people's health, livelihood, and ability to survive are at stake. I think museums are a little bit at the end of that road of like what institutions will we be looking at. And I think we have to look at the racism that was underlying a lot of the assumptions at that time too, and right now rethink it. And so if museums are saying, well, you know, this one, I mean, the law says this was exported, you know, before the UNESCO laws went into effect, so this one is legal. It went out of India, before the laws. Well, what about the ethics of it? And obviously, it doesn't make sense for museums to hang on to these artworks if there's a party on the other end who wants it back. So I think another really important argument for us to not accept right now is that the norms were different at that time, and that nobody blinked an eye, and that this was just the way that business was being done, because that's actually not true. So, looking through the historic record, the 1960s in specific, before the UNESCO rules went into effect governing trafficking, there were a lot of people calling out the trade. And e as you see, even people like Sherman E. Lee were stating that the trade was bad and that it was bad to be looting and that this was unethical. So I think that it's a little too easy to say, well, this was business as usual. It was business as usual for people to act badly in a knowledgeable way, but I don't think we can say that people didn't know that they were acting badly at the time.
Elizabeth Kadetsky is a three-time Fulbright scholar in India and an editor at the New England Review. Her article, The Goddess Complex, was published in The American Scholar. Elizabeth, thank you so much for making time for this conversation.
Thank you so much, Chris. This has been so fun having this conversation. I really appreciate it.
You can find us on Facebook and Instagram and subscribe to our podcast wherever you like to get podcasts. Just search for KERA Think or listen at our website, think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.